So this morning we're going to start a series in the book of Daniel. I've actually had a couple of people speak to me, ask me, or suggest to me that we look at this book together. And it's, of course, been our Bible book of the month for this month. And I've been struck how relevant it is to our day and to our situation. It's a book that has lots to teach us, but I think there's two main lessons, two main things that it teaches us. It teaches us how to live for God in an ungodly world, and it teaches us that God is still in charge in an ungodly world. So I think in many ways those are the two great main things that will come out of it. How to live for God in an ungodly world, and remind us that God is still on the throne in an ungodly world. There's two things we need teaching on, and we need to be reminded of. If we're Christians, we're probably feeling more and more like Daniel, having to live for God in a world where God isn't recognized, where God is opposed, having to live for God in a world where increasingly we're in the minority and we're outsiders. We're aware, aren't we, that what we believe and the things that we hold dear are almost completely rejected and opposed in our day. And perhaps we're feeling that more and more, that even though we love our country, we love where we live, and we've got much to enjoy and much to be thankful for, yet at the same time we feel like we're living in a foreign land. And this isn't our home. And we're aware, aren't we, how different we are, how different our thinking is to the world around us. Well, hopefully this book will help us, teaching us that we don't have to despair. We don't have to go and dig a hole somewhere and live in it. We don't have to sort of just wring our hands and sort of, you know, oh God, how terrible everything is. It's teaching us how to live, this book, in an ungodly world, reminding us it's possible to do that, reminding us that God is still in charge, still on the throne, and well able to help us and keep us and enable us to make a difference in the world where God's put us. So it's an encouraging book and helpful in that way. Now, it's a book of two halves, for sure. The temptation when you come to Daniel is always to say, I'm going to do a character study of Daniel. Because the first half of the book's great. You know, it's all those stories that we love, and you children will know them all. It's the account of the lives of Daniel and his friends, and it's wonderful. The second half suddenly gets very different. We have what we call apocalyptic language. So we've got these visions and these dreams and all sorts of strange creatures, and we're suddenly in Revelation or something like that. But and so we're going to have to, unless I change my mind, we're going to have to wrestle with that as well. But it's still the same message, actually. The first half and the second half are still telling us how we can live in ungodly worlds, and telling us God is sovereign and on the throne and working out his purposes in an ungodly world. Okay, well, I've told you the bit of the history, 605 BC, here we are, and Daniel and his three friends then are among the first group to be taken back to Babylon. And I want us to think about four things then, four questions. You'll see if you have a sheet this morning, four questions. Has the Lord been defeated? Will the Lord be forgotten? Will the Lord come first? And can the Lord be trusted? So let's just think about those four questions for a while together this morning. Has the Lord been defeated? That's the first question. And when you look at verses 1 and 2, you know, it's a legitimate question to ask. It certainly appears that way. So we're told how Nebuchadnezzar has come to Jerusalem and he's besieged it. This the city of God is surrounded by the Chaldeans, by the Babylonians. And Jehoiakim caves in and surrenders. And Jerusalem, this great city, is taken. And then we're told, aren't we, in verse 2, how he takes some of the articles from the temple, from the house of God, and takes them and puts them in the house of his God. Now, that was something that you would do in those days, that you would take some of the idols of the nations you defeated, or in the case of they didn't have idols in the temple, of course, so some of the articles for the temple, and you would take them home to the temple of your God, and you would put them at the feet of your God. There you go. Our God has defeated another God who's fallen to the God, the mighty God of the Babylonians. You may remember that something similar happens in the book of Samuel. You remember, perhaps you children remember this, when the Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant and they take it and they place it, don't they, in the temple of their God, Dagon. And there he is, supposedly defeated. Well, it doesn't work out very well, turn out very well for Dagon in the end, if you remember the story. But that's what happens here. So Nebuchadnezzar arrogantly, proudly walks into the temple. Only the priests were supposed to go in there. He takes whatever takes his fancy from the articles in the temple. He takes them back to Babylon, into the temple of his God, puts them there. There you go. God's defeated. Another God proved to be weaker than the mighty gods of the Babylonians. And so the question is a question that has to be asked. Has the Lord been defeated? Surely that's where the evidence points. Judah defeated, Jehoiakim just a puppet king, all the articles now in the temple of the gods of the Babylonians. Surely he's defeated. It's over. It's the end. All that history, and it's finally come to a conclusion. And yet, of course, what we're going to discover in this little book is that though Jerusalem remains defeated all the way through this book, and actually Jerusalem is destroyed during the time of this book, and though all those articles remain in the temple of the Babylonian God, God is very much not defeated. He's on the throne. He is working out his purposes and his plans, and he's very much alive. And interestingly, in this book, it isn't so much Daniel who declares it, although he does declare it. Very often it's these very emperors themselves who are going to acknowledge and say, there is only one God in heaven, the Lord. So whether it's Nebuchadnezzar or Darius or whoever it might be, they're going to be the ones that declare it. And actually, if you look at these verses, even those opening two verses make that clear. Look at verse 2. How is it put? And the Lord gave Jehoiakim into his hands. So Jerusalem's fall isn't ultimately due to Nebuchadnezzar. No. God has given Nebuchadnezzar Jerusalem. God is just fulfilling his purposes. He's being true to his word. He's showing himself to be the sovereign God. He's doing what he warned he would do. God is on the throne. And these kings and these events are in his hands. And it's important for us to remember that, isn't it? Because people are asking that question today, aren't they? Is God dead? And there are plenty of people who are declaring that that is the case. Certainly in the West, the church seems so small and so weak. I mean, how many little chapels do you go past and they've been turned into houses? And you say, another place gone, and God's pushed out of the public square, isn't he, in our day, in our society. And Dawkins and others like him are declaring, oh, it's all over. We're in the death throes of religion and of Christianity. The God of the Bible, we've placed him at the foot of the God of science and evolution and humanism and hedonism. He's dead. He's over. His day's done. And we'll soon bring an end to it. And we can begin to feel like that, can't we? If you're at school and you're the only person who goes to church, or you're the only Christian in your class or in the workplace, and you're the only one. And we can wonder, is this the end? Well, the book of Daniel is encouraging us to remember that God isn't defeated, that he is in control. He's still working out his purposes, and we need to keep following him even when everything seems small and dark and weak and impossible. Has the Lord been defeated? The book of Daniel laughs at such an idea. Second question, will the law be forgotten? That's verses 3 to 7. That is certainly what Nebuchadnezzar is seeking to ensure. He was a very clever man, Nebuchadnezzar. This was part of his scheme for building and keeping his empire going. Nebuchadnezzar knows that his empire is growing too big. He's not going to be able to keep everybody in tow by force. He's just not got a big enough army. He just can't do it. And so he's very clever, and what he seeks to do then is to take the best people from every country he defeats, the most promising pupils, take them back to Babylon, and basically turn them into Babylonians. So that's his plan. So there in verse 4, the bar's pretty high, isn't it? Young men who with no blemish, good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand. And so on. I think I might have got in, but I'm not sure how many more of you would have made it. But this is the best. He gets the best, doesn't he? And then he goes, his aim is to get them, make them to forget their background, forget their identity, immerse them in the culture and the language and the teaching and the religion of the Babylonians. That's the plan. Make them Babylonians, basically, is his plan. And that's what happens then to Daniel and his three friends. They're four of a large number who were taken back. And try and imagine it. Now, Daniel, we think, was about 14 years old. I don't think there's anyone here 14 yet, are they? No, not quite. I can't remember. No one's acknowledging it, even if they are. Anyway, so he's 14 years old. Think about that. You young people, think about that. 14 years old, taken away from your parents, away from your home, away from your country, away from everything you're familiar with. Taken hundreds of miles away to a country where everything's different. Different people, different culture, different language, different clothes, different food, different religion. And you are captives of these people, and you must obey them. And when you get there, they put you on a 3-year training program to immerse you in the ways of the Babylonians. And the promise is that at the end of it all, if you do well, you've got security, you've got a job, you've got a place in the kingdom. They're saying with a smile on their faces. There's no tuition fees. There's no student debt at the end of it all. All of food is all included. Nebuchadnezzar's going to provide all your food for you. All you've got to do is forget your past, forget who you are, forget your old ways, forget your old country, and become like us. That's the plan. And that's the purpose in the change of their names, isn't it? They don't just give them names because they find it hard to pronounce their names. You know, my name changed from Hugh to Who when I came to Norfolk. But there's something more sinister behind this change. So these four boys have great Bible names, if we can put it like that. So Daniel means God has judged. Hananiah means Jehovah has been gracious. Mishael means who is like God. Azariah, Jehovah has helped. So their names deeply rooted in their Hebrew religion. But their names have changed. So Daniel's given the name Belteshazzar, which means keeper of the hidden treasures of Baal. Hananiah is given the name Shadrach, which is another name for the pagan god Marduk. Mishael is given the name Meshach, which is an ancient form of the god Venus, the god of love. And Azariah, and he's given the best name, isn't he? Abednego, which means servant of the god Nebo. And so there's a purpose in that. Not just to give them names, as I say, that the Babylonians can pronounce, but it's an attempt to get them, forget your past, forget who you are, forget where you've come from, forget your religion, and become like us. Don't forget, your God lies at the feet of our God anyway. Can you imagine the impact this could have had on these four young men? They've been cut off from everything they know, taken to a far country, and an attempt is being made to mold them and shape them and make them into Babylonians. And thinking, dressing, eating, living like Babylonians. And it seems that that is the only way they're going to make it in life. That's the only way they're going to be successful and get on if they do that. It's a promise of a successful career in the Babylonian civil service if you will just go along with these things. Will the Lord be forgotten? Well, let's apply that to ourselves for a moment, because, well, we haven't been taken captive and taken to some foreign country, but we are living in a world and a society which is seeking to shape us. It is seeking to mold us. It is seeking to make us forget God and worship the gods of that it's worshipping, the god of pleasure and money and man. And it's bombarding us all of the time with its thinking and with its agenda and saying, this is how you must think. This is what you must do. This is how you must act. And if you don't, well, there's serious implications. It's important we understand, don't we, what's going on in our world. You young people, you young adults, you need to recognize that. They're on television and on social media. It's trying to shape you. It's trying to mold you. It's saying to you, this is how you must think. This is how you must act. This is what matters. This is what's important. Now, that isn't new. The world's always been like that. So if we began the service with Romans chapter 11, the end of it, if we'd read on a couple of verses further, we would have had the Apostle Paul saying to us, do not be conformed to this world. Because Paul knew this world, even back then in the first century, was trying to shape and mold these Christians and influence them and say, live for the things we're living for, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. And so we need to understand that. So here we are, we come together on a Sunday, how vital that is. And we're reminded of Jesus and of the gospel and of the things of God. But we go out into the world and the world is telling us exactly the opposite. Forget God. Live for the day. Forget these truths that you consider. And we might feel, you young people might feel, it's to go along with it is the only way to be popular, the only way to get on in life. The pressure's on. Will the Lord be forgotten? What about you and me? Will the Lord be forgotten? Third thing. Will the Lord come first? This is verse 8. So what's Daniel and his friends going to do in the face of this very pleasant but very real onslaught? This attempt to mold them and get them to forget God. The question really is, will the Lord come first? Or will Daniel melt in the face of such pressure? Well, in verse 8, look at verse 8 then. This is a key verse. We read, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacy, nor with the wine which he drank. Now, what does that mean? Well, let's deal with the food issue first of all for a moment. It's clear from verse 8, there's lots of opinions about this, by the way, but it's clear from verse 8 that Daniel felt that eating, for whatever reason, eating and drinking this king's food would defile him. That's his word. That's it. That's his concern. Probably some of it would have been some of the unclean foods from that they were forbidden to eat in the Old Testament. Although not all of it. I mean, he mentions wine here. Wine was not an unclean food. Perhaps it involved, well, it most certainly involved feasting to the Babylonian gods as they ate. That was what it is. In some ways, in a similar way to we would say grace at the beginning of a meal and we should eat to the glory of God. Well, they would feast to their gods. Well, for whatever reason, this was the thing that Daniel felt. Here is where I must stand firm. Here is where I must stand apart. And he couldn't do this, he felt, without serious compromise. And so we're told that Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not eat. Now, interestingly, just note this, that it doesn't come out in our versions, but the Hebrew, the same Hebrew word that's translated purposed here, is there in the previous verse. So in verse 7, the chief of the eunuchs gave names. Now that word gave is the same Hebrew word, purpose. So the king of the purposed is to give them a name. So he's got a purpose. He's got a determined purpose in giving them these names. Well, Daniel then has now got a purpose. He's determined not to let that shaping, changing happen. Now, let's think about this then for a moment. I like the way the New King James translates this because it shows where the battle was. Some translations simply have Daniel resolved not to eat or determined not to eat, and they don't mention the word heart. But the word heart is there in the Hebrew. And really, that is where the battle was. That's where the decision was made. This was ultimately an issue of the heart. So we understand, don't we, that when the Bible talks about the heart, it's not talking about the organ that pumps the blood around the body. It's talking about who we really are. So in the Bible, we think with our hearts, and we believe with our hearts, and we desire with our hearts, and we feel with our hearts, and we make plans with our hearts. And that's where the battle went on. What did Daniel really want? Who or what was first in Daniel's heart? Who had the central place, if you like, in Daniel's heart? What did Daniel really love? You see, that is the issue generally in our lives. Generally speaking, it's not, as we go out and live in this world, it's not that we don't know what the right thing to do is. I mean, sometimes that's the case, but generally we know what we ought to do. The issue is, do we want to do it? The issue is with our hearts, whether we have the heart to do it. What's going on in our hearts is usually the deciding factor in the things we do. How things are in our hearts is usually the deciding factor in what we do. It's a matter of what our hearts love, which is why the Bible says things like Proverbs 4, verse 23, guard your heart, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it flow the issues of life. That the heart is the main thing, isn't it? Out of it flow all the things that you do in your life and all the issues of life. Or in Psalm 27, verse 8, when David says, when you said, seek my face, he says, my heart said to you, your face, Lord, will I see. The response comes from the heart. So do you see, we're seeing what's going on in Daniel's heart. We're seeing who comes first in Daniel's heart. That was the battleground. So we understand that even at this young age, here's Daniel, he's 14 years old, but at some point, God has already worked in his heart. That heart of stone that we have, that's hard towards God and says, I want my own way, has been changed. He's got a heart of flesh. He's got a heart that wants the Lord, that knows the Lord. And so Daniel's come to trust the Lord, and that's going to be the battle that's going on in, all the way through Daniel's life. It's the battle of his heart. So can I ask you this morning then, can I look you all in the eye and say, how is your heart this morning? Who reigns in your heart? What or who do you love most in your heart? Are you conscious this morning as you're here that God has changed your heart? Do you know that? That's what we all need, don't we? That's what God does. So perhaps if you're honest, you're here this morning Can I put it like this? But your heart is not in it, really. You're here because of, for 101 different reasons, to please somebody else, because you just have to be, or whatever it might be. But you perhaps you look around you and you say, well, I'm not like other people. Their heart's here. Their heart's in it. And I know that mine isn't. Well, if that's you this morning, then I would just urge you to cry out to God. To change you, to save you, to deal with your heart. To give you a new heart. That's what's happened to everyone here this morning who's a Christian. And brothers and sisters here this morning, the battle of living in an ungodly world is not fought out there. It's fought in here. This is the battleground in my heart and in your heart. Who reigns? Who rules? What's going on in here? Who's on the throne here? What are we allowed in here? What have we purposed in our hearts to do or not to do? That's the battleground as we live in an ungodly world. Guarding our hearts, asking God to help us, to give us a clean heart, a heart that wants to walk in his way. So Daniel purposed in his heart. It's an act of devotion. Just a couple of other things about that. The wording suggests, doesn't it, that Daniel thought about this in advance. He purposed in his heart. In other words, Daniel, as he comes, he's in this situation. And he's thinking, isn't he? He's thinking, okay, here I am. He doesn't just sort of go and hide away. He couldn't do that anyway. But he's thinking, isn't he? What can I do? What's okay to do and what's not okay to do? What can I enter into and it not defile me? But where's the line? Where do I have to draw the line? And he's thinking about that, isn't he? And he's thinking about that in advance. So he's not going to make decisions on the fly, as it were. As much as he can, anyway. And then notice also, he makes it at the beginning. He didn't think, well, I'll just get through the 3 years of training and then I'll make a stand. He doesn't go, well, if I can get myself in a position of influence and get myself in a good place, then think what a difference I could make. No, he says, doesn't he? He makes his stand straight away at the very beginning. And of course, this sets him up for the whole of the book. You children, Daniel would never have made his stand in the face of the lions then, if he hadn't made it here at the beginning. Or Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah would never have made their stand in face of the fiery furnace if they hadn't made their stand here at the beginning. And of course, this wasn't the only thing that Daniel purposed in his heart to do when he was young. You can just turn on to chapter 6 and verse 10 with me. When Daniel goes to pray, even though there's been a decree that he shouldn't pray or he'd be thrown into the lion's den. Sorry, there's a few spoilers going on here, but I think most of us know the story. What does he do? He prays and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. He's purposed in his heart. Not just not to eat the king's food, but to pray every day and not forget the Lord's. So, this is an example to us, isn't it? So we've already thought, this is a battle with our hearts. We've got to guard our hearts. But we need to be like that. We need to purpose in our hearts. We need to think through, each of us individually. We're in different stages of life, different ages, different circumstances. Our issues may all be very different. But we need to think about our lives. Where are the pressures in our lives? Where are the temptations? Where is it that I need to draw the line and say, I won't do that. And we need to think ahead, don't we? We need to think about our lives and think about the pressures that are on us. And say, well, I won't do this. This is where I will make my line in the stand. When my friends at school do this, I won't join them in it. When people at work do that, I won't go along. When the pressure is put on me to do this thing at work, I will stand firm. Or positively, as Daniel obviously did with that praying, a purpose in our hearts to read our Bible and pray every day, or to get to the prayer meeting as much as we possibly can, or to be proactive in speaking to other people about the gospel. I'm going to purpose in my heart to do that. Now you might go, oh, Hugh, but that's sort of list, isn't it? That's getting Pharisaical. But I'm sure that there were people in Daniel's day who said the same thing to him, because there were plenty of Jews who came, who didn't go along with Daniel and his three friends, who said, oh, come on, Daniel, it's only food. I mean, what does it really matter? But we need to be definite, don't we? We need to be specific sometimes. Jonathan Edwards, not the triple jumper, the theologian, was a brilliant mind, but he wrote lots of resolutions, didn't he? Things that he covenanted before God that he would do or he wouldn't do. And we need to be specific, living in an ungodly world in that way. Will the Lord come first? Will he come first in your life and my life? Fourth thing, and we're going to be really, really brief now. I know this is a big section, but we're just going to deal with it quickly. Verses 9 to 21, can the Lord be trusted? And really, you could sum up the rest of this chapter with the words from 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 20. What are they? Them that honour me, I will honour. Them that honour me, I will honour. So here are these three men. They're determined, four men, they're determined to put God first and honour him. And so the Lord honours them and helps them. And that, we saw that in various ways, don't we? First of all, verse 9, God brings Daniel into the favour and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. So God does that. God overrules in that. I'm sure that Daniel was a pleasant enough chap and it was easy to like him, but God's got this eunuch's heart in his hands and he can turn it whichever way he wants, and so he does. And Daniel's wise, isn't he? And he's firm, and yet he's gracious. You know, when the man's going, well, you know, I don't want to lose my head over this. Then he suggests, doesn't he? Well, let's just try it for 10 days. And he's firm, isn't he, Daniel? But he's gracious, and he's wise. And then the Lord honors them also, doesn't he, in making them, even within those 10 days, stand out as far better than the rest. Now, if you, generally speaking, if you get an advert for a diet that says in 10 days you'll be completely revolutionized, the good thing to do is probably ignore it because it won't work. But clearly it's the Lord's doing, isn't it, here? He works. Now, perhaps some of you are getting a bit nervous this morning. Does this mean that we've all got to go home and chuck our roast beef or whatever it is we've got cooking nicely at home in the bin and just eat vegetables? Is that what we're to take out of this? Well, no, it's not, is it? Well, the New Testament makes clear that is not the case. The Lord is clearly overruling this. This is Daniel's line in the sands. The Lord honours them in that. He also honours them, doesn't he, by giving them great wisdom and understanding. Verse 17. God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature, so that they stand at God gifted them, God helped them. Now, I'm sure that they didn't all just sit around and do nothing. I'm sure they studied hard and worked and gave themselves. They took their stand on this and they said, well, we better get on with our study. We better do well. And God helped them and blessed them in that, so that when they come to the end, they're not only better than all the other students, they're better than all the other wise men in the land, and they're 10 times better. So the temptation would have been to think, okay, let's just conform. That's the only way to get on. But no, honouring the Lord was what they should do. Now, of course, we understand, don't we? Everyone here this morning, I hope, understands that if we do what's right and honour the Lord, it doesn't always end up like this. You don't always end up at the top. I mean, there are people, let's be honest, there are people in prison in other countries this morning because they've gone, right, let's do the right thing and honour the Lord. So don't, you know, we can't take out of this, okay, well, if you honour the Lord, you sail through all your exams and everyone will love you and you'll make it to the top of your profession. We can't do that. But that's what the Lord did here. And the thing is, whatever the circumstances, however he does it, in this life or in the life to come, we know God honours those who honour him. Daniel and his three friends, they haven't got the book of Daniel. When they decide to purpose in their hearts, they don't know the king might take their heads off by the end of the first day. But they trust God, and they honor him, and they leave him with the consequences. Let me say one more thing as I finish. Imagine having to stand before King Nebuchadnezzar. Must have been quite something, wasn't it? Stand before the emperor. You children, think of this. The emperor of the whole world. He can take your head off, and nobody says a word. You know, no one's going to question him. And you know, the media aren't going to come in and go, oh, well, this isn't very good. No, he can do what he likes. Imagine having to stand before him and face exams before King Nebuchadnezzar. You can imagine that would be fairly alarming. Well, let me remind you this morning, every one of us here today is going to have to stand before someone far, far greater than Nebuchadnezzar. We're all going to have to stand before Jesus Christ one day in the judgment. And do you remember what Jesus said? Whoever honors me, owns me, I will own and honor him before my Father in heaven. See, that this is what's going to matter, isn't it, on the day of judgment. Not that we earn our salvation, of course. We've seen that already. We honoring God involves trusting him and casting ourselves on him. But man, there's a day coming, isn't there, where we're going to have to stand before the king of emperors, the man who, the God who just moved Nebuchadnezzar where he wanted him to be and made him do what he wanted him to do without stopping him doing his own thing, but he overruled it all. And you and I are going to have to stand before him. How will you want to have lived when that day comes? Well, surely trusting Jesus, casting yourself upon him, and then with his help and with his grace, seeking, feebly as it might be, to live in a way that honors the Lord in his world. Well, may God bless his word to us, challenge us, help us as we look at this book together, change our lives through it, for his honor and for his glory.